everybody, and welcome to Raya Affairs. My name is Francia Morales, and I'll be your host for this episode.
Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders and the behind the scenes of decision makers and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, I'd like to give a disclaimer that the opinions in this episode are welcome, even though they might not be a direct reflection of Raya's stances as an organization, as we specialize in unbiased writing. In today's episode, we'll be focusing on Sudan and Hemeti, one of the leaders of Sudan, and we'll be talking to Gova, who recently wrote an article about this. Gova, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Francia. Thank you so much for the introduction. Well, I'm Covadonga Moreno. Cova Moreno, and I'm Spanish. I'm a journalism and international relations graduate, and I'm also super excited about what's to come in my academic journey as I'm enrolled in a master's in diplomacy and global governance. And well, as for Raya, I started as an intern in 2022 and have been collaborating in the research and analysis in the communications team since.
Very nice. Thank you so much for your very nice introduction. Gova is a very well-established part of the team, and we really appreciate her writing. And this article was actually really good. But before we dive into it, I wanted to ask you something that we ask everybody, so it's kind of a rite of passage. And that question is, could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world would you want to have a conversation with, or a dinner, or like a chat over the phone?
Definitely a dinner. And this question is pretty asked, but let me tell you, I honestly never seem to find like a nice answer. But with this one, I'm confident. So I'm hoping counts as a leader. I'm talking about Martin Luther, the father of Protestantism. So yeah, what drives me to choose this leader and to consider him as a leader per se is that I think he changed the course of Western religion in history. There's close to 800 million Protestants, which is like 40% of all Christians, and that's a lot. And not only he put forward like a belief that represents this many people, but he also kind of forced the Catholic Church to reform and build more of what we now know as the Catholic Church. But further than religion, which I understand it's not reference for many people nowadays, but he had such an impact on history also. The schism that he provoked within Christianism was also reflected in the European empires and kingdoms to the point of adding to the outbreak of the 30 Years' War, which completely altered Europe. So by the end of this war, the Peace of Westphalia was signed in 1648, and this is considered to be the beginning of the modern and new like European order. So I think it would definitely be fascinating to listen to Martin Luther's take on these like happenings.
I got full body chills by that answer. Kova, thank you so much. That's really interesting. I actually really love that question. I was thinking about whether I would answer this differently now, because when I was on this podcast, I said I would have dinner with Genghis Khan, and I would still be very interested to have dinner with him just because he made dinner such an occasion. I don't know if he'd want to have dinner with me. He didn't do much with women except like violent things. But I was also thinking that maybe I would have dinner with Margaret Thatcher. Not that I am particularly attuned to her. But then I thought that maybe I would find it really inevitable to copy her voice. Now that we've had a nice chat and Gova gave us that very profound answer that I appreciate very much and I think I'll think about for the next week, we'll dive into your article. So you recently wrote an article on Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, or also known as Hemeti, who is sort of the second or co-leader of Sudan at the moment. As we know, there's been increased media attention in the civil war or civil conflict that's going on in Sudan. And this increased media attention has really highlighted the grave human toll of the current uptick in the conflict there. Before we get into that, do you think you could give us a quick rundown of what is happening in Sudan right now and why this conflict has emerged?
Definitely. Well, Sudan, as you said, is embroiled in a pretty severe conflict. And that conflict is between two major factions. So there's the Sudanese Armed Forces, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who is also head of state. And then on the other hand, the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, and they're commanded by Mohamed Hamdan Hemeti Dagalo, who is also vice president of the republic. So this past April marked a year since the outbreak of the civil war. However, I found it difficult to pinpoint like the beginning of the conflict in the country, as well, Sudan has undergone plenty of violence since it became an actual independent country in 1956. So that's also something to bear in mind when analyzing this conflict. Nonetheless, the civil war could be traced back to the military coup of 2019, when both al-Burhan and Hemeti together overthrew President Omar al-Bashir, who had led the country for 30 years, and not precisely through democratic means. So 2019, a transitional sovereign council was established, aiming especially at the construction of a civil democratic government. And of course, al-Burhan and Hemeti were heads. Al-Burhan was chairman and Hemeti deputy chairman. So in 2021, however, Hemeti, not surprisingly, through another coup, dissolved the council, this council that they had settled, and reinstated it as a military junta. So the issue really comes when, besides this rivalry that had born, the framework agreement was signed in 2022, and it was intended to be like a blueprint for the democratic transition. What's the problem? That this framework was determined the demilitarization of the government and the integration of all the armed forces, including the RSF. And Hemeti was not fond of this. So April 15th, 2023, he deployed his forces in several Sudanese cities, including the capital of Khartoum, and resulted in the beginning of the civil war. And well, we'll have time to talk about this later, and I won't expand much. But there have been a number of attempts regarding meetings and negotiations to achieve peace, but they have not been successful at all, mainly because the leaders refused to attend.
Great explanation, Kova. Do you think you could maybe go a bit more in depth on who is Hemeti and how did he make it to the Transitional Council? How did he make it to the head of the RSF? And who really is this character that we're looking at who is being partly a great imposition to the dissolution of the conflict in Sudan?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me tell you, I think that he's a super interesting figure to analyze. He's extremely driven, and that shows in his escalating in the power ladder. So he was originally a camel trader from the Darfur region. He's original from an Arab ethnic tribe settled in that area, which is important because when the Darfur conflict rose in the early 2000s, he joined the Janjaweed and became its leader. And by the way, the Janjaweed is a paramilitary considered to be predecessor of the RSF. And it has also been repeatedly accused of committing crimes against humanity and like many other violations of human rights. So anyhow, Hemeti became al-Bashir's right hand and was made the commander of the RSF when they were created in 2013. Then, as I mentioned, he led a coup against al-Bashir together with al-Burhan, and a few years later, in 2021, led another coup against al-Burhan, igniting the war. So what's interesting here is like there's this pattern of treason or of rebellion against his own allies, you know? So all of this for what? Well, Hemeti rose against al-Bashir, and he got to be in the government, got him a seat in power. And then he rebelled against al-Burhan and has positioned himself as an actual, like, an alternative for the headship of state, or at least that's what his intention or what he's leading on. So you can see here a lot of drive for power, and his African tour is also a perfect example for this. So he has been touring the African neighbors, talking about peace and transition and getting to make like very strengthened diplomatic ties. So at the end of the day, that is him almost running as a candidate, you know. So his whole strategy is super beneficial because he has put also Al Burhan in a fight or flight type of situation, and he has flown. So Al Burhan, yes, he has isolated himself. He has refused to attend meetings, negotiations. He has suspended Sudan's membership in the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, which is a main mediator in the conflict. So Hemeti is a very smart figure. He's also a very wealthy leader. He's in control over the main resource of the country, which is gold. And this is also a really important driver, because losing control over the RSF, as would happen implementing the framework agreement, would make Hemeti unable to maintain his control over these gold mines. So definitely he has resources to like fight the fight, and he has a big reason not to give in, his like economic reasons and also his drive for power. And of course, the absence of Al Burhan, which he has kind of achieved, is playing on his favor.
Wow, this is really incredible and intricate, that it's not only the consolidation of power within the country, but also kind of proving to everybody else around him, this is how things are going to be from now on. And that hasn't really, what's also interesting is that his establishment of himself as the de facto leader has not really led to a cessation in conflict or to any dampening of the violence that civilians are experiencing, or the deployment of troops. So it seems like Al Burhan is really still trying to fight the military fight at home and has not focused on the outside perspective, whereas Hemeti has. So to go deeper into this, back in March, the ins and outs of the civil conflict in Sudan were still quite tangled up. We still didn't really know where things were going. And as things were explained in the article, we still didn't have a clear-cut future. And more recently, as I mentioned before, the media attention has rightfully highlighted the civilian cost of the conflict. So only in the last year, so not even considering all of the previous 30 years that you've also outlined, we've had more than 16,000 people killed in violent clashes. And since independence, this is up in the millions, including the civil wars, the other civil wars that Sudan has been through, as well as the fact that there are 8 to 10 million people displaced either internally or have already fled Sudan, as well as 25 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, on top of an impending famine. For I believe the UN described this as hundreds of thousands of people in risk of famine. So besides this obvious gargantuan humanitarian cost that is clearly not imposing any real cost on the leaders, what politically has changed for Hemeti and Al Burhan? What are the real costs for them, or what might have changed, or what might have to change in the future for there to be a concession? What have we seen move in the chessboard?
Well, as you say, there has been an intensification of media attention on Sudan. Sadly, however, it has been because of the death toll, the ongoing displacements, rather than because of any advancements, because there have not been much, let me tell you that. So there's a stalemate between the leaders that is persisting. As I said before, there have been attempts by external actors to revive the peace negotiations, the Jeddah process it's called, but time and again, one or the other refused the invitation, so the external actors have been unable to get the two leaders together. After March, not much has changed. The United States planned a meeting for April 18th. It didn't happen. Saudi Arabia also attempted at mediating, but that was also unsuccessful, although the Saudi foreign minister did get to talk to both leaders separately, but there's also not been advancements on that front. And United Nations actually adopted a resolution calling for a ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, but again, it wasn't respected. So, yes, moving forward in the achievement of peace, it's not looking very good right now. But the ambitions of the leaders don't seem to be moving forward either. So there's an interesting blockage there where neither the conflict nor the leaders' ambitions are moving forward, while, as you said, violence keeps like enduring and casualties keep growing. And yeah.
As these negotiations are planned and then they break down, you've mentioned already the United States, you've mentioned Saudi Arabia. In your article, you mention the United Arab Emirates, and there is also sort of mention of Libya and Turkey attempting to broker some sort of peace or ceasefire or negotiation even to bring people to the table. And I wanted to know, how are these players involved or invested in peace or lasting or a lasting ceasefire in Sudan? What are the specific interests of these North African players, these Gulf players, and more international players in Sudan?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been the one that lately has taken like the upper hand in the negotiations, but as I said, not very successfully. But there are a variety of reasons why Saudi Arabia and many other regional and international states would get involved in the peace agreements in Sudan. Firstly, and perhaps I think the most like obvious, is the increasing humanitarian crisis. Again, there are, as you said, 25 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, close to 10 million displaced. And the hunger crisis, it's threatening to become the worst worldwide. So, for example, the United States also has announced that it's going to input $47 million in humanitarian aid for this year. And as well, many other countries are aware of the situation. And for example, the European Union is also aiding. But well, going back to the United States, I also wanted to highlight another special interest that the United States has in achieving peace in Sudan, which is to safeguard international security or like their own security, by preventing the creation of safe havens for terrorists, especially after 9/11. This is being a very high point of their strategy. So usually areas of conflict become these safe havens for terrorists, and this is what they want to prevent by getting involved in the peace negotiations. Another reason of interest is the strategic location of Sudan. It's right in the Red Sea. So, for example, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and now more Egypt too, in the last few months, which are competitors in the Red Sea, they find very attractive an ally in the Red Sea, as it would be like really beneficial in terms of geostrategy. The same goes for the regional stability and the influence in the region. Libya especially is really keen on this aspect, as it has concerns over the security of the region, because the intensification of the violence could also spill over to its borders by means of trafficking, armed groups, etc. So peace would be really beneficial for Libya and also other countries neighboring Sudan. And lastly, I would like to mention economy, which is also an important factor, because for instance, also Turkey and Saudi Arabia have investments in Sudan, mainly in agriculture, in the agriculture sector, and of course, evidently, this sector is incredibly damaged in times of conflict. So basically, to sum up, the states are basically aimed to the achievement of peace in Sudan, and they are driven by, I'd say, a combination of strategy, economy, humanitarian motivations, a mix of all of those.
Yeah, it's a very thorough analysis. I think from what you say, I mean, my following question is sort of about the idea of a path forward. And this is always complicated to ask, because if you think of the history since 1956, it feels a bit like a silly thought experiment to say, okay, what is the path forward towards peace? And I assume that the best hope that we can have, or at least that the great powers like the United States has, or maybe a big regional power like Saudi Arabia, the best case scenario might be for them that there is a figure like Hemeti who overpowers the situation. They might want to balance Al-Burhan's interests as well, but I guess the best case scenario is for there to be an all-out victory by one group that can establish peace and reestablish stability, especially if we're considering the interests of countries like Libya, which I'm assuming the European Union is also quite interested in, given that Libya is a very, very close partner with regards to, as you mentioned, human trafficking or human migration. So that's really just the thought that I had now. But in your opinion, or in your view of things, do you believe that Hemeti's legitimacy has been cemented, or that it's on its way to be fully cemented? And on top of this, do you think that this means that there is a path forward without his role persisting, or is the only path forward with him in the picture?
Okay, so this question, it's rather difficult, honestly, because I think there's a very thin line between the analysis I can make with what I know and the opinion that I may have. And also, well, I always find hard talking about future scenarios. So there's like so many possibilities, and I don't want to have you here like 3 hours talking about Hemeti. But I'll try not to ramble and do the best I can. So to start with the question, is Hemeti's legitimacy cemented? No, I don't think so. It is true that there has been like a strengthening of his diplomatic ties. He has presented himself as an advocate for peace in Sudan, in as to being like open for negotiation. And he has definitely changed his image at regional level. He has transformed his image of warlord to that of a statesman. But he's not considered to be neither the legitimate leader of Sudan nor the better candidate, to put it some way. So I think he has definitely secured himself a more political profile, and perhaps following this path, he could somehow cement his role as leader of Sudan. But for now, I don't think that's the case. And as for moving forward without him, well, honestly, I don't see Hemeti withdrawing anytime soon. It doesn't fit his profile or his history. But given the situation in which he was no longer in the picture, I believe that there are several possible scenarios. So on the one hand, there could rise a new figure from the RSF and take over as the leader. And thing is, that person may or may not follow like Hemeti's newest diplomatic attempts. So given the situation, there's a risk of having a rather like a more violent RSF, and therefore moving forward in the conflict would be like even harder. And then on the other hand, I think that there could be a scenario in which the RSF are incorporated into the armed forces, which, if you ask me, it's honestly really unlikely to happen with him in the picture. And this alternative, the integration, could be a driver for the development of peace, although given the nature of the militia, I would not be optimistic about the chances of this peace lasting. So basically, I think that in order to achieve peace, Hemeti, or at least a figure like Hemeti, should be in the picture. However, things should need to change, as right now, Hemeti itself, it's not making any moves forward to achieving peace. So things should need to change in either his like figure or in the like context itself.
Well, that's really great in-depth answer, Kova, which I think this segues very perfectly into the last question that I have for you, which would be, in order to wrap this up for our listeners very well and to kind of really place it into perspective for them. What do you think would have to happen for a ceasefire and lasting peace to exist in Sudan? What are these factors that you believe would need to change? On top of this, what is in the best interest of Hemeti to happen? What does he want or need to happen in the future? And then what needs does he need to balance of Al-Burhan's for this to move forward? What do you think?
Okay, well, for starters, in order to achieve a ceasefire, the two leaders would have to meet, which we've seen that it's rather difficult. They're stuck in this like spiral where one won't be present at a meeting because the other one is there and vice versa. So that spiral, it's very, very difficult to stop because the ideal would be that violence decreased. So their mutual like reproaches to one another would kind of be calmer because most of their reproaches so as to not be present in a meeting are the violence within the country. So if this situation would ease off, conversation perhaps would be easier in order to reach a ceasefire. However, a ceasefire is not the same as lasting peace, of course. And for the ceasefire, they would need to find like this momentum where their enmity wouldn't be as like vivid as it is right now. But for lasting peace, I believe that there's the need of like a wider structure change within the government itself. So basically what ignited the civil war that we talked before was a framework agreement. And there's what I believe that should be the focus for the lasting peace. So this framework establishes like a path towards democracy. But does that democracy fit into Sudan? Because, I mean, democracies, I feel like they can take like very different shapes. There's like the one in Spain, it's not as the one in the States or in India. Like they take very different shapes according to their history, their culture, etc. And so with this in mind, I believe that it's kind of a mistake to try and implement like a rigid democracy in a country that hasn't really known democracy. And so perhaps what should be done is to try and create a laxer democracy, like be laxer with this transition, even if it takes longer to achieve like an actual democracy. So Al-Burhan, what he wants is to stay in power. Okay, and Hemeti, what he wants was to have control over the RSF. So as I see it, maybe the framework should like remove this clause on the integration of the armies and instead include something to somehow limit their power. I don't know if I'm just rambling here, but the leaders would be in this situation, I think that happy enough for a certain period of time where they could actually be able to sit and talk about a peaceful and democratic path moving forward. So yes, I think that maybe the negotiations and the they shouldn't be so focused on installing like a rigid democracy right away and peace right away. Rather, they should focus more on being able to fit everyone in the framework as to be able to talk, because that's the problem right now. They cannot talk.
Wow. Okay. I think this paints a really complete picture of all of the moving factors right now that are relevant in Sudan and how sometimes it's not as simple as doing one thing or another, especially with the needs of many different people involved, their interests, maybe even the interests of their own militias. Obviously, you have this idea of maybe Hemeti is also considering the promises he made to his militias or the promises that Al-Burhan made to his own military. And I think this is rather an interesting story of Hemeti's treason against his seeming friends. I think this is a really intriguing story. It's also very heart-wrenching to know that the results of this sort of treason is the violence that we're seeing right now. And hopefully, from what you say, in the future, we can see at least a cessation of hostilities, at least humanitarian corridors, at least humanitarian assistance reaching the population of Sudan, and eventually something like what you mentioned, with a lasting peace in the country. So thank you very much, Kova. This was extremely enriching. I have to say, I have really deeply enjoyed listening to you speak today. I've enjoyed asking you questions. I knew from editing your article that there was so much left unsaid because of the general limits that we place on word count and how we have to write the articles, which is why it's so important for us to have these episodes so you can really go more in depth into all of the analysis that you really have about this topic. And with that, dear listeners, we are closing this episode. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening. I know that this is an episode that is worth listening to. And so we thank you for coming. We thank you for listening. And we will see you next time.